Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
Joan Mulvihill is with us, as is Francis Fitzgerald, former Taoiseach, of course, member of the G7 Advisory Council. And we're joined as well by Thomas Byrne, Fianna Fáil TD and Minister of State at the Department of Foreign Affairs, and, of course, Minister of State at the Department of Defence. In that capacity, Thomas, your reaction to, I mean, Declan Power, when the question was put to him, the security analyst, described this as a national embarrassment. The fact that drones flew for an hour around the LE William Butler Yeats, the Defence Forces, they say, legally unable to engage, and the first time that President Zelensky has been this overtly targeted coming into a European capital.
I think President Zelensky has been targeted on numerous occasions. There's a lot of people want him dead, quite frankly. And the fact is that he arrived safely and flew home safely from Ireland. It's a bit farcical. I don't know if anyone did suggest this, but to suggest that Dublin's the only place facing this. We've had drones all over Europe. In Lithuania, they have helium balloons being sent across the border from Belarus, which closes the airport on a regular basis and is extremely, extremely dangerous. So this is going on all over the place. The Defence Forces could have engaged with these drones if they consider themselves to be under threat. That's a fact. And I do want to thank the Gardaí and the Defence Forces. I saw some TDs cribbing in the paper about the level of security. I mean, the level of security was absolutely appropriate to President Zelensky's visit. And I think our Gardaí and our Defence Forces did a fantastic job. They're not responsible for drones flying in the sky. They're responsible for, dealing with them if that's necessary. And I obviously can't comment on any specific situation. But the fact is, the President Zelensky arrived and went very, very safely. Now, but it is also a fact that he's under threat. There's no question about that.
There's two elements of the reporting. I want to come back to whether or not they could have engaged with the drones. A lot of the reporting is saying that part of the reason that he arrived successfully and safely was not that there was a suitable interdiction of the drones, but rather that there was a false deadline provided for his arrival. So the timing was what made him successfully get in safely. It wasn't that the Defence Forces did a brilliant job at interdicting these drones.
Sorry, I mean, I assume that the arrangements for his arrival were done in close coordination with the airport authorities and the security authorities as well. And quite frankly, as someone who was in the airport waiting for him, the time kept changing. Now, whether that was for security reasons or not, I can't comment and don't know. But one can only imagine that that has something to do with it and that they take all types of precautions. So and just to say, like, I absolutely accept that the Irish state needs to spend more on defence, and the Irish state is committed to doing that. The government is absolutely committed to doing that since the last government, and we're constantly upping our capacities, which are left to go to a very, very low base. But this is an issue for President Zelensky all over, everywhere he travels. And his movements are done in complete secrecy. The time I was in Ukraine this year, I met President Zelensky actually briefly at an event commemorating, you know, hundreds of people that were killed and buildings destroyed, unfortunately. The Pope's funeral was the next day. The word was the president, I met him at like 7 o'clock in Kyiv. The word was he couldn't travel to the Pope's funeral. I switched on the TV the next morning at 10 a.m. and he's in the Vatican. So his movements, I assume, are kept very close to the chest. And I would say the arrangement's done at the last minute and with very few people knowing what's actually going on.
Let me ask you then two parts of the reporting in the Sunday Times today. You said that the Defence Forces were within their rights to do whatever they saw fit in terms of engagement. What the Sunday Times is saying is, and I quote, the Naval Service could not legally shoot them down under its established rules of engagement. It was also fearful of causing damage to residential housing. And they say that the Irish Military Intelligence Service and Garda headquarters are now running a national security inquiry into what happened in the events. Do you believe, therefore, they could have shot them down if they wanted to?
Sorry, they make the operational decisions, but the law is clear that they have the right to do so if they believe that they're under threat. So they have, but they have to make the judgment at the moment. I'm not standing there like, you know, or Minister McIntyre, the Taoiseach, like Winston Churchill at the Siege of Sydney Street, was directing the police what to do in terms of a riot, or indeed some of the stuff we're seeing across the water at the moment. These are operational decisions, and we have to put our trust and our faith in our Gardaí, in our defence forces, and yes, equip them with the equipment that they need to do their job, which is what the state is setting about to do.
You say setting about, do you think we have a distance to travel?
I think we have. I mean, that's well known. I mean, we established the Commission on the Defence Forces in the last government, and a plan was put in place from there, which is, first of all, to put the foundations in for proper defence forces that we need to protect the country, to protect our citizens, and to build on that. And that work is ongoing. Only 2 weeks ago in the Dáil, I was the minister before the Defence Committee looking for €90 million to put an anti-drone defence system in place at Baldonnell, which we're doing anyway, but we want to accelerate it to some extent in advance of the EU presidency. Dublin Airport has made its own arrangements on drones. So that work is ongoing, and every few weeks you'll see another announcement from the Department of Defence as to extra capacity that's been procured. And I certainly want to see that spending going up, because we need to protect ourselves. That's what it's about.
Frances Michelle, do you think there is a, is it politically challenging to suggest further monies be spent on defence and security? Is there's limited votes, I would think, in saying we need to invest in anti-drone technology? And
I think it's changing, Anton. I really do. And I think this was a stark reminder of the reality of where Europe is at the moment. When you see Russian submarines off the coast of Ireland, when you know about our infrastructure under the sea that needs to be protected, when you see a leader coming in and drones, this is a stark reminder of the situation in Europe right now, and it impacts on Ireland. I think we were in denial for a long time. I think we have a more realistic debate discussion now. This is a stark reminder. It's a very challenging, a very intense time. We heard Putin say this week that if Europe wants war, Europe will get war, which I found extraordinary.
And went on to say, if there is war with Europe, there will be nobody left to negotiate with.
Well, I mean, this is Putin. This is what we're up against. No wonder my colleagues in the European Parliament from Eastern Europe are so terrified with their close proximity to him and the history they have of where he was going. We have to be realistic. And this was a reminder. It was very interesting to read this interview with the Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Rossa Mulcahy, where he actually says he's changed his view of what is needed militarily in Ireland, that he's moving away from the belief about the idea of a leaner military. And clearly the debate has to be realistic about, we have to have more anti-drone technology. We hardly have legislation for delivering food in Dublin 15 in relation to drones. We have to have more anti-drone technology. We have to have more technology generally. I was in Denmark a few weeks ago and they had the presidency. If you listen to what they did in relation to security, they're NATO members. They had borrowed French ships were in the bay and around the seas. They had more drones. They were borrowing from other countries because they're NATO members. Now, we will have to exchange security. We'll have to have backup. It's very challenging for the government to decide how are we going to ensure a safe presidency.
Denmark also had incursions from drones during the leaders.
It doesn't stop
it. So nobody's immune from this.
Nobody's
no
immune.
But we're
going to have to be, you know, very lean. We're going to be relying on people for exchanging information. We have to have a safe presidency.
Can I put to you the threats thing that is often there said by the others, the people who would counter the argument for further investment in militarisation in Ireland, which is they say that much of what we're seeing, the action taken by Russia, is a function of NATO expansionism. It's a function of increased militarisation in the West, and that it is goading Russia into the kind of action.
Did you see what Putin said about Ireland? Does he see Ireland as neutral? Absolutely not. We're not neutral in terms of our values. We're not neutral in terms of what side we're on. We're neutral militarily, but that will be tested. And we have to do everything possible to have a safe presidency. We have to develop all the technology within our neutrality that we can.
John Mulvihill.
I think Francis raises a really good point. So unlike Francis and Thomas, I'm not from a political politics background, but I think as a regular citizen and voter, we do need to have a more mature conversation about what our neutrality actually means and how we put it into action. It seems that we say we are neutral, but we're not neutral on our, as you say, on our values. We have taken sides. We're very clear we are on the side of Ukraine. So where is neutrality? What does it actually mean when the rubber hits the road? I don't think we've ever really felt under threat in this way before. And yet when I was reading through this, I had no idea that we were talking about, you know, people, Irish fishermen off boats who are, you know, with offer bribes to move equipment on behalf of what, Russians? Like, these are things that most citizens are just not aware of. And I think if we want to justify, and they're saying here, European presidency, anti-drone technology, an increase of 1.7 billion in the military budget between 2026 and 2030. I don't think citizens will have a problem with supporting that when they understand what that has been spent on and why we need to do it and where it's actually impacting Irish lives now. Because, you know, we want the Lieutenant General Rossa Mulcahy talked exactly to Francis's point about investing in the military, and he talks about attracting people to work in the military. He talks about how we're going to have to recruit people, how we're going to have to retain people in their careers there, and the options for careers in the military, which are quite different around cybersecurity. My background is in tech. We have a really, really strong, you know, professional cohort of people working in that sector now. And maybe we need, maybe the military need to be doing more. We need to say how to create you know, attractive careers for people there.
Recruiting some of them, actually.
Recruiting some of them, and how you can support that through, you know, reservist programs.
You talked there about, John, about the level of knowledge and acceptance among the citizenry. Thomas, can I ask you on that? As Minister of State and Defence, you've a fair insight into what the threat assessment is. Are you concerned? Do you believe we are actually under threat, or is it overblown?
No, it's not overblown. I think, first of all, the perception of threat is different in Ireland than it is in Eastern Europe among the general public. And that's a fact, and it changes no matter, depending on what country you go to. But there certainly are threats there. We know about them. There's the Russian shadow fleet, which is moving around Europe, I suppose. We don't have the full extent of that. We're imposing sanctions on that to deal with it. We're putting in place radar and sonar as well to make sure that we have a full cognizance of what's going on. There certainly are issues concerning our cables. And that is an issue that, for example, was brought up with me last week in the Latvian Parliament, where parliamentarians, by the way, a number of whom were very, very helpful on Brexit, you know, they got to know the country very well. They visited Ireland a number of times, and they're still in Parliament and their successors. And they're asking me then about cables, and they refer to our cables, not the Irish cables, but our European cables, because this information over these cables is serving all of Europe. So they certainly want to know what we're doing. They don't want us to join NATO. They're not looking for us to militarise, but they want us to protect what needs to be protected. And I would say in those countries, they are now spending 5% or more of their GDP on defence. Certainly Latvia, Lithuania, Poland and Finland would be among those. But Russia, and this is why they're spending this, Russia is spending nearly over 7%, I think, of their national wealth on defence. And they keep and Russia is spending way more on defence than they are on social spending, for example. So that's where the threat is. They've seen exactly what's happened with Ukraine in terms of a land war. There's a huge information war going on at the moment all across the European Union. That's an absolute fact. And these hybrid attacks, what's happening now with these hybrid attacks, these, like, for example, even the one this week, and again, I don't want to go into it, but there have been examples in Lithuania. Say 4 years ago when I was in Lithuania last, the Belarusians, of course, controlled by the Russians to a large degree, are sending migrants from all over the world. They're pushing them across the border. So it's difficult. It's a humanitarian situation. But for government authorities, it's an inconvenience. They have to set up camps, etc., and deal with people which as humanely as they can. But now what's happening is that these hybrid threats are getting more dangerous. So the helium balloons from Belarus into Lithuania could knock a plane out if they're not dealt with properly. The IKEA, one of the IKEAs, I think in Vilnius in Lithuania, was burnt. There was a fire started by a Russian agent. The person was put in prison there last week. And there are other issues as well. So what's happening is they seem to have stepped up in dangerousness. And that's what we're told by the security people in Lithuania and Latvia. And I would say about those countries as well.
See, I wonder, Thomas Byrne, is there a sense in Ireland that we say, well, it's terrible and tut, 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 but it's also Eastern Europe and miles away from us?
No, I think if it affects them, it affects us all. Because you see, the invasion of Ukraine has affected all of us, whether it's through migration, whether it's through increased energy costs, whether it's through the economy slowing down. So there's a huge cost to all of this, no matter where it happens. In Lithuania, some of the senior security people and some of the senior politicians in Latvia and indeed Lithuania as well, they're very familiar with Ireland. Some of them have worked here for about 10 years. You know, there's a huge, like, there's a huge Lithuanian connection with Ireland since they joined the EU. So they know Ireland really, really well. They're very fond of Ireland, I would say. They all love Ireland. But they have questions about defence. So certainly what they've asked me to do is to explain, as best I can back home, that the threat they face is one to their very existence as a state and a people. And that's the exact words of politicians and diplomats. And that's the threat that they see, that they perceive. And they know the threat for us is different, but that it's still there. But they want us at least to understand it. And I think a lot of Irish people do, quite frankly.
I think we had a false sense of, you know, calm, that we were different, we were neutral, that would protect us. I think what we're seeing in recent times is that what's happening generally with the Ukrainian war, the invasion, is that it begins to touch everybody in Europe. And we are being touched in a variety of ways. You mentioned misinformation, disinformation, Thomas. We did a report in the European Parliament. I don't think Irish people, or English people for that matter, realise the level of interference that is going on all the time by Russian and Chinese. I was at a G7 meeting recently. We were looking at transnational repression. What many countries, including Russia, including China, are doing to their citizens in European countries. So that's another element of it. But the misinformation, I mean, I'm sure Brexit was impacted by misinformation. No question of it. And, you know, they will make every effort to interfere with elections. We saw that recently in Romania and Moldova. So we are in a world of, you know, sadly, of much greater threat. It's such a change for everyone of my generation who kind of thought, you know, a liberal world, you know, going towards peace and security, everything's been upended.
Now, with me is former Taoiseach Francis Fitzgerald, Thomas Byrne, Fianna Fáil TD member or Minister of State at Defence and at Foreign Affairs, and digitalisation expert John Mulvihill. There is an Ireland Thinks poll in the Sunday Independent, which details the country's attitudes across a number of issues. And one of the issues it looks at is politics. And what it has revealed is bad news, Francis Fitzgerald, for your party. Fine Gael's popularity continues to wane. And the vast majority of people think that Simon Harris taking on the Department of Foreign Affairs was daft.
Well, that doesn't surprise me in relation to him taking on finance, because if you ask members of Sinn Féin or Social Democrats or Labour, of course they don't want him in that, you know, good position and that powerful position.
Well, so I didn't get
surprised.
The sense there was a huge majority of Fine Gael voters who thought it was
actually,
a wonderful idea.
There's far more. So it's a gap of 20. Actually, so there's quite a gap. So Fine Gael members are quite happy about that. But I rather like Kevin Cunningham's article where he says, with Fianna Fáil up 2 points and Fine Gael down.
Thanks for saying that.
In the latest Sunday Independent Ireland Thinks poll, one could conclude that this poll is mere noise, falling as it does within the margin of error since our last poll. However, of course, I mean, there's a lot of...
Falling being the operative word.
Yes. And of course, all opposition leaders last month were down, and quite a few of them are down. So it's a very this poll, but it's a very fluid poll. Let's say that.
Ah, come on, Francis. We were told that Simon Harris, first of all, we were meant to get the Harris hop. He was the energizer bunny. He was going to bring in us all this energy. Then people, including you in this room, said that he had a great success in the last election because though the percentages weren't wonderful, he had refreshed the entire team and brought in all this new blood. Where is the evidence of all this?
Of course, that's part of the challenge, because you only have two members in the Fine Gael part of the cabinet that have more than 2 years' experience. You have a new team who are, you know, obviously they're a year, some 18 months. So there is a challenge building up a new team. I think that's part of it. Also, the move from Taoiseach to Tánaiste, I think, explains a certain amount. Micheál, I think, is up. Fianna Fáil are up in this poll. I think the whole Zelensky visit, that kind of coverage you get on a national and international event, shifts it. But he, you know, when you think about the election, the 2 points that Simon spoke a lot about were infrastructure and migration. And we're now seeing all of those accelerated moves in infrastructure across the government. And migration, clearly there is a mood for, you know, greater, you know, a stronger approach.
Is there
to the
just
migration
a weariness,
issue?
Do you think, Joan? Are people at this point, A, fed up with Fine Gael being in government since, 2011? And B, there is a sense that the two parties have become one and they have been there since God was a boy.
If I was totally objective, I'd have to say Fianna Fáil being up two and Fine Gael being down two does show that there's a certain fluidity of maybe people are just going, oh, one or the other. I think it's interesting, though, you mentioned about Simon. But actually, interestingly, Holly Cairns as a leader is down three. Mary Lou is down one. Micheál Martin, despite all odds, sorry, Thomas, is up 3. I would have thought after the presidential thing that might have been down a bit. But Simon is still holding his own. So as a Fine Gael leader, you could argue that his support from his own party, obviously, is not down. But I think what's interesting is that...
But what's the party support?
As you say, as the general fatigue of things, I think the idea that if you look into the issues, and Francis just mentioned, you know, housing and immigration there, what's lovely to see is that immigration as an issue to deal with is down 9%. And actually, the rise of the far right was another issue that was mentioned, and it was down 1%. So I think that we're possibly, you know, there's a bit of maturity coming into that debate now. There's a bit more action being seen to be taken to manage these things constructively. I mean, you know, obviously cost of living and housing is still, you know, the biggest issues that the government have to deal with. But we are still early in a term. And as you say, and I mean, Thomas even admitted this too, this is really, really early days into a term of any government. And these polls are a bit of a moving feast, really, aren't they? It's a mood check more than anything else.
I honestly think that the election is always its own dynamic. But you know, the official line, of course, always is that we don't read the polls, we don't believe them, but believe you me, if there's a plus sign beside your party and beside your leader, you're always happier.
Horoscopes, political polls and weather forecasts. Believe them if they're good.
But can I say this? I would say this, though, in terms of, and this is to me as a government minister and to my colleagues, I think we need to have a razor-sharp focus on the issues that matter to people, which I think, in fairness, is what the Taoiseach and ministers are doing. It's housing, cost of living, immigration. Immigration is down as an issue, probably because Jim O'Callaghan is dealing with it so well. Healthcare, poverty, the economy. They're the big issues. There's a lot of other issues there that the opposition focus on, literally all the time. And backbenchers can feel, and ministers, sorry, all of us can feel under pressure on certain issues. I think the government takes a consistent approach on all the issues, but the real focus needs to be on housing and cost of living.
Can I ask a question on this about whether or not there is a bubble developing on some issues? Because one of the things that I thought was very fascinating about this was we've spent a week, spent several months, spent several years, but we've spent particularly the last week having discussions about RTE deciding that it is the moral arbiter and wants to pull out of the Eurovision Song Contest because of the presence of Israel, renaming a park in Rathgar because it was named after Chaim Herzog. And you listed the list of things that people regard as important issues. They were asked, what are your top two most important issues? 3% of people said Israel and Gaza.
Yeah, and I think the government has taken a consistent position on Israel and Gaza. And I think that's very good. And the Taoiseach and the Foreign Minister are doing, you know, and the rest of us who deal with these issues, I think are doing the consistent Irish job.
Why is it soaking up millions of column inches of public discourse?
Well, there you go. And I think people need, certainly my own colleagues need to be reassured that we are certainly, I think, taking a consistent position on that. We're not targeting this as the main issue, unlike some of the opposition. And we're right, because the public are concerned about housing and the cost of living, and we need to be absolutely totally focused on those issues, because they are the most important issues. They are the issues that will affect a general election. I absolutely accept that the war against Gaza was terrible, the attack on Israel was terrible, but it should not be the major focus of a government. Yes, in the foreign ministry, yes, the Taoiseach, we should absolutely be focused on it and continue to do it. But there are those, particularly in the opposition, who spent like literally their entire political lives dealing with this issue.
Now, there's a lot of government who have been strong on it. I mean, Simon Harris in the Occupied Territories bill was pushing
for a long time. Well, I accept the genuineness of people and why they would want this to be a big issue, because they're horrified by what they see. I absolutely accept that. But we cannot have a strong foreign policy unless we have a strong country that's strong economically and strong socially. And they are the issues, I think, that we have to put first in this country.
Is there a disconnect there, Francis, with that figure? I mean, I was just very interested.
Well, I'm not sure that there is, because, you know, the media will focus on different issues sort of week to week, and the renaming of the park, 51% disagree. And that got huge coverage because it was brought up in the city council and so on. And so many disagreed with it. In fact, you know, the outcome was reflective of what people are saying here. They didn't think it should be renamed.
Yeah, but when people are actually, when somebody goes up to you in the street and says, give me the two things that matter most to you, but almost nobody is saying Israel and Gaza.
No, that's true. Most people would say housing, and most people would say cost of living because of the increases. I mean, it's the bread and butter. It's the economy, stupid. I mean, these are the things that people care about in terms of how are they going to wake up tomorrow and where are they going to live and what's their income going to be and how much is food going to be in the shops. But I mean, I think it doesn't mean that people don't care about Israel or care about Gaza or care about the war. I mean, I think that's still very preoccupying for us.
Hang on for a second. I'll come to you in just one take. Yes, John?
Yeah, I just think that's a fair point. It's a question of timing. I mean, obviously, people will put their own needs first. They always do. But we've just had an entire conversation about, you know, national defence, whether or not we are scared. We are always concerned and we're always going to give the answer of what is the most immediate threat to me, my family and the quality of my life. And therefore, you will say housing. But it, we can hold two realities at once. And I think that's the really, really important part. I would be lying awake at night thinking about...
I think that it's very easy to take what is now obviously the broad view on Herzog Park that shouldn't be changed. Very easy to come to that view when you talk to the Jewish community. And that was the entire of my response to it, that I have spoken to the Jewish community in recent months in Ireland, the Irish Jewish community. And they are suffering at the moment. There are certainly issues going on in this country that the people in the Jewish community in Ireland, which is very, very small, are feeling. And their feelings need to be understood. And this issue went very much against the Irish Jewish community.
Yeah, can I ask you on that, Tom? Sorry to cut across you, but it's...
And I need to say one more thing, that Dublin City Council needs to stick to the day job. They should not be dealing with foreign policy. They should be dealing with housing, the various issues there, that, insofar as they come under their wing, and not be dealing with these issues and taking their focus away from what their job is.
A text has come in saying, I do not support the government's stance on Israel. We clearly have an anti-Semitism issue in this country and the government refuses to acknowledge or address it. Now, would you describe as the reaction of the Jewish community? Last week, I was talking to a journalist who has a Jewish daughter, and he was describing the experience of being father to a Jewish child in Ireland and describing it as being bleak and describing what he saw as consistent instances of anti-Semitism. Alan Shatter has described consistent instances of anti-Semitism. And the reaction that we tend to get by text is that is a misinterpretation of anti-Israeli sentiment being seen as anti-Semitism. Is there truth in the anti-Semitism allegation?
I think there is an uncomfortable feeling for Irish people who are Jewish. This has nothing to do with Israel. This is Irish people who are Jewish. This is our fellow citizens, people that maybe live beside us, who have been in Ireland for generations, just like the rest of us. They're just Irish people like everybody else. And at times they feel uncomfortable in the country and it has nothing to do with Israel. And this is just an example of it. And what we saw at Dublin City Council was, as I said, not sticking to the day job, dealing with foreign policy, but conspiracy theory after conspiracy theory, if we're quite frank about it. There was allegations made that Mossad or someone was ringing up ministers. The only person who contacted me about this was a member of the Jewish community from Ireland, the Irish Jewish community, somebody with an Irish passport who lives in Ireland. They're the people that are contacting me about this, and that's how they felt.
What do you think, Francis? Has the line become blurred between disgust at Israeli military policy and overt or covert or implied anti-Semitism?
I can really understand the vulnerability Irish Jewish people feel. Absolutely. I think it's incredibly easy to understand it. The debate about the park renaming, I mean, that was, I thought it was appalling, I have to say. I can see how it could be misinterpreted as anti-Semitism. I can see that very easily. The huge support for Palestine is often seen in that way as well. So the vulnerability increases for them. Do I think that is true of the average Irish person? No, I don't.
No,
I don't. Not at all.
Exactly.
I really don't.
The poll shows it. Majority of people, an absolute majority of people do not want this park renamed.
Yeah. So that's, I think, the view there's of understanding, people. But I think your question is right, Anton. It would be very easy to feel extra vulnerable and then move to the point of feeling this is anti-Semitism.
The problem is, every time there's a discussion about anti-Semitism, somebody somewhere brings up, oh, well, you're broadening the definition of anti-Semitism, or you're weaponizing anti-Semitism, or etc., etc. Why can't we just listen to the Irish Jewish people and listen to what they're saying? To me, that's the simplest way of dealing with the issue. And then as a government and the rest of us trying to deal with the issues that they raise.
John?
Yeah, I mean, I've partaken in some of the marches in Dublin supporting, I suppose, the Palestinian people. And that doesn't make me anti-Semitic in any way. I don't think the park should be renamed either. I totally agree with that. I can totally separate out personal feelings about, you know, my horror at the genocide that's taking place in Gaza, and understanding that there are people of Jewish faith who do not necessarily support the Israeli government or the Israeli defense, you know, attacks on Gaza either. So they're two very, very separate things. But I think we need to be very, very careful too, that in all of our understanding, that we don't also become we shouldn't become afraid to be against and speaking our minds. And I think if every time I feel like I'm saying I'm pro-Palestinian that someone would say, well, that means you're anti-Semitic. Absolutely, I'm not. I'm anti the Israeli policy at the moment. I'm anti their offence. I lived in London during the 90s. You know, I lived there when the IRA were bombing, you know, parts of London. And I know what it feels like to be someone who's gone, oh my God, somebody, a taxi driver said to me once, oh, I see your lot are at it again. And I said, not my lot. They don't represent me. So I think I can understand that difference between a nationality and a belief or a faith or you're not, your government's policy versus a terrorist group's policy. They're very, very different things. And we need to be able to be comfortable and confident to have those conversations without feeling like I'm going to be accused of being anti-Semitic.
Lastly, before we wrap up, there is reporting. I think that they just blow the dust off this story and rewrite it with a new date every couple of months. The Children's Hospital is being delayed again. It looks like we're talking now mid-2027 before it is going to be completed. Thomas Byrne, at this stage, are we ever going to have this?
I know we will, and it'll be brilliant. We will, and it'll be brilliant.
But the children will be adults by then.
There'll be plenty of children that will need this hospital and will need world-class care. Look, I mean, there are contractual issues there. Clearly, the construction has not been in any way satisfactory. Don't get me wrong.
A lot of the issues that have gone to mediation have been found for on the behalf of the contractor.
Well, that's why you have mediation. So these can be decided.
But it would point that the client hasn't exactly been wonderful either.
Well, look, I mean, the mediation is there to ensure that we have a contractual process and it's not a political process as well. So we need to make sure that we get this. That I know Minister Karen McNeill has spoken and she feels it's unfinished. It is unfinished and she's not going to take over a hospital that isn't fully finished. I think she's adopting the correct approach on that. She's set out various issues with BAM and I support her on that. And you can't open a hospital that's not finished. But I have absolutely no doubt when this is over, it'll cost. I accept it's cost too much money. Absolutely accept that. It's not open soon enough. I absolutely accept that. But I know that this will provide, when it does open, world-class care for Irish children.
Thomas Byrne, thank you. Thomas Byrne, Fianna Fáil TD, Minister of State at Department of Foreign Affairs and at Defence. Francis Fitzgerald, thank you. Likewise, former Taoiseach, the member of the G7 Advisory Council. And likewise, thanks to Joan Mulvihill, digitalisation expert. Text say, I don't care what religion a person is, Jewish, Catholic, Protestant, whatever. I don't support anyone who thinks what Israel is perpetuating on the Palestinians is right. That's not anti-Semitism. That's pro-humanity. Well, if
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion. It's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.